John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on. He captured Harper's Ferry with his 19 men so true. He frightened old Virginia till she trembled through and through. They hung him for a traitor, they themselves the traitor crew, but his soul goes marching on.
This is Our Numinous Nature, and I'm your host, Philippe. We'll be hearing the profound stories of people with a deep connection to the natural world, from herbalists to hunters, wildlife rehabilitators to trappers, artists to homesteaders. The list goes on. My hope is to thread a needle that weaves together the many nature-related passions through stories of reverence. In nature, I've found meaning, a richness for life that grows with each new day. Maybe you feel the same, or maybe you long to. Today's podcast guest is Mike Smith. He is the former superintendent of Droop Mountain Battlefield State Park in West Virginia. And he is such a cool and passionate guy, and I met him through a mutual friend. I really like this episode. It's a lot of fun. We talk a lot about the history. Obviously, him being the former superintendent of a battlefield, we talked a lot about the history of the battlefield, the Civil War in that area, which gets into even more exciting topics such as people's experiences with ghosts on the battlefield, with his own archaeology, metal detecting work, a book that he didn't co-author, but he helped put together with a guy named Terry Lowry, is a book called The Last Sleep, The Battle of Droop Mountain. I have a link for that if you want to buy that through Amazon. And then we get into fossils and fossil hunting, love all that. And that's like the first hour. And the second hour, we get more into Mike's personal life with how he grew up hunting and cool animal stories, like with hellbenders and with a turtle party that they would throw at their house, fun stuff like that. So he's just such a cool guy. And when I got to his house, you know, winding up this West Virginia mountain, and I turned onto his long gravel driveway, he was standing in the driveway with a recurve bow and in kind of like a felt Western hat, and with his huge white beard and glasses and a quiver that he had made from an elk that he hunted out west, and just such a cool guy. Cool and passionate. So before I say thank you to everyone on Patreon for helping out, I want to say thank you to some new listeners. And if you're super new to the podcast, I know when I get into a new podcast, I don't necessarily scroll back and look through all the episodes. So I just want to do a quick shout out to some old episodes. If you enjoy on today's the talking about fossils, well, I've done two really cool episodes with fossil hunters in the past. In 2020, I did one called Church of the Cretaceous plus the Pteranodon Skull with fossil hunter Chuck Bonner. And that was out in Kansas, in like the big wide open country in the Kansas chalk beds, and talking about Cretaceous era fossils. A year later in 2021, I did one with Paul Murdoch, who is a fossil hunter in the Chesapeake Bay, primarily the Calvert Cliffs area. That episode was called Sharktooth Sea Warrior plus the Ghosts of Dead Horse Hollow. That one also gets into some Civil War history and the paranormal and ghost investigation. I love all that stuff. So definitely check those episodes out if you've never have. If you're interested in more of the kind of history and paranormal, I did an awesome one in 2021 called Pirates of the Chesapeake Bay plus the Pungo Witch and Other Hauntings with living historian Alpheus Tuning. Why I bring that one up is In that one, Alpheus told a story about Civil War reenacting and having a phantasmal ghost experience while reenacting. And that's a topic that comes up on today's episode when we get into the Civil War history. I would like to say thank you to Feral Forest Folk for being the new Patreon patron. They have started their own podcast, and I recently did an illustration for their logo. So check them out on Instagram, Feral Forest Folk. So everyone at the highest tier, huge shout out to Kendall Wine, Ash Barron, Rachel Hawkshaw of Topsy Farms, who will be having a rabbit processing workshop, a homesteader workshop in June. If you want to check that out, Practical Homestead Economics is the Instagram account. So check that out. Alexander Kurashev, On Stanley, Kaylee Lindman, Craig Kovering, Diana Gonzalez, Earl C. Suter, Eugene Elliott, Franklin Renshaw, Heron O'Brien, Jacob Griffin, Jamie Nudd, James Mann, Jeff McLaughlin, Les Padgett, Kenneth Giles, Leslie Peterson-Cohen, Michael Zorn, Michelle Alderson, Michelle Miller, Nathan Griffin, Ryan Arnold, Rambler, Ryan Goeckner, Sophie McVicker, T. Pierce, The Militant Hippie, Tristan Harper, Tyler Lively, Waddle and Dob Craftsman, The Working Class Woodsman, and everyone at the lower tiers, thank you very much for helping this out. And let's get into some reading. So when I have done actually two episodes with West Virginia paranormal investigator Les Odell, he gave me this little booklet called Confederate Ghosts by Susan Kreitz. And in this, Susan Kreitz in the Eastern Panhandle has compiled a handful of Civil War ghost encounters, firsthand encounters, recording it or transcribing what people's stories are. So I'm going to be reading one of those. Now, this is not anywhere near Troop Mountain. Troop Mountain is in the Allegheny Highlands of West Virginia. This story takes place in the Eastern Panhandle, a few hours away. Author's note. She is a tall, stately woman in her late 30s. She is a social worker and a graduate of Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia. Her home is one of many in Martinsburg that was built before the Civil War. For several years, she has been restoring the home. I met with her a few days after she had completed the renovation of her basement. This is her story. I inherited this house from a rather distant relative. It came as quite a surprise. I'm not the last of the line. I didn't know my great-great-uncle well at all. His will said that the house was to go to the eldest female minister or social worker in the family at the time of his death. I had been living outside of Baltimore when I received news of my inheritance. I had just purchased a condominium, so I wasn't sure what I would do with the property. I took some leave and traveled to Martinsburg to see the house. I was surprised that it was in such good repair. I think I expected a tumble-down shack because I was told that my benefactor had been a rather secretive and hermit-like character. I spent about 6 hours in the house on the first day. I looked in every corner of the building, from the steep gable attic to the dirt floor of the basement. I fell in love with the place. It felt warm and inviting. My friends thought I was crazy, but I put the condominium on the market and moved into my inheritance in Martinsburg. The condo sold quickly, and I made a tidy profit. I immediately used the money to upgrade the plumbing and the electrical system in the house. I then decided to renovate the basement. The basement is quite large and is the only place I could fit all of my photographic equipment and darkroom. It has gorgeous flagstone walls and an unusually high ceiling. Its only drawback was the dirt floor. I hired a contractor to excavate about 18 inches and install a proper floor. The work began on a rainy Monday morning. The men moved the dirt all day. While others might have gone to a motel or arranged to stay with a friend, I was fascinated with the work and wanted to photograph every step of the renovation. that night, after the men left and the dust settled, I went down to the basement with my camera. I was shooting this and that when I heard a low murmur. I stopped, looked around, and listened with care. I heard the murmur again. It was a man's voice. His words weren't clear, but I could tell that the sound was coming from the west corner of the room. I walked into the corner and saw that it was the deepest level of excavation in the room. I couldn't hear anything else. I decided I had heard the sounds of an old house creaking and moving. I went to bed just after the 11 o'clock news that night. Something awakened me, and I looked at my clock radio. It was 3:21. Suddenly, the house was filled with the mournful sounds of a man singing. His voice was wonderfully melodious. The song was wistful. I wasn't frightened at all. I was drawn to the voice. I could hear every word of the lyric clearly. I will never forget hearing him sing as I walked the two flights of stairs to the basement door. When I opened it, I could see the basement was bathed in a dim, flickering yellow light. Across the room, propped on the flagstone of the west wall, was a Confederate soldier. He was wounded in the right leg and in the abdomen. Blood had seeped from the wounds onto the dirt floor. I knew he was dying and wanted to rush to him. Instead, I stood transfixed, unable to move or utter a sound. He looked at me with eyes full of pain and sorrow. Yet he sang to me as if he knew me. I can hear the words to this day. Teller, too, when on my bed, slowly ebbed my being's stream, how I knew no peace until mother kissed me in my dream. When his serenade had come to an end, he lifted his hand to beckon me closer. I walked over and tenderly kissed him on the forehead. A last breath came from his lungs. His eyes lost their focus and stared into eternity. I don't remember leaving the basement or going back to bed. I awakened the next morning to the knock of the workmen at my front door. I threw on my robe, let them in, and fixed myself a cup of coffee. I sat at the kitchen table, waiting for them to call up to me when they discovered the body. I really wasn't myself that morning. I will never understand why I didn't go into a panic and call the police. It just didn't enter my mind. About 10 minutes after the workmen had begun, the call from the foreman came. I went down the stairs and saw the men all standing back from the place where the man had died. They parted as I approached them, and I saw the foreman leaning over the spot. "Ma'am," he said, "I believe we have unearthed the remains of a Confederate soldier. There's only a bone or two, but the buttons, sword, and some rotting materials are surely from a Confederate." Author's note: she never reported the discovery, and the workmen kept it to themselves. The sword hangs over a display case filled with his personal effects. She has a framed piece of sheet music hanging below the sword. The music is of a Civil War era song entitled "Mother Kissed Me in My Dream."
The U Mountains of West Virginia, about halfway up the slope of Viney Mountain, in a big, about a mile and a half cirque, semicircle facing to the southeast with sun beaming in, 60-foot cliffs above us, and rocky hillside with timber coming down to us. We're in a little clearing, little peninsula that sticks out in the middle of that cirque. Where the sun beams in. That's why we put the house here, because, you know, we like the sun.
So we met through a mutual friend, and at a little historical event that they had locally. You came dressed in buckskins, and I had some of my furs out, and we talked for like probably 30 minutes or 40 minutes. And I just found everything you were saying was so fascinating. I was like, you know, sometimes when I'm looking for these podcast guests, either I search out a topic and then I just want, you know, go to a museum, find someone great at the topic. But when I'm looking for an individual like yourself, I look for a little sparkle in their eyes, and you got a sparkle in your eye. So,
well, thank you. I guess that's good.
Oh, it certainly is. So, you know, I loved so many of the things we talked about. Now, I'm wondering even where to start, but, you know, I know that you were the past superintendent of Droop Mountain, and I saw a little video online of you talking about the old growth trees that were there, and I think there were some issues with maybe those were going to get logged. I thought, yes, what a cool thing to talk about would be some of the like the really special trees and old growth forests that are still here in West Virginia. So,
sure.
What, so sure. Are, did some of those trees prevail over at Droop? Or?
Well, yes, there are several there still. There's all maybe 12 or 15 big red maples that of a couple that fell down across the road of the same size. All of those were in the 325, 350-year-old range. There was one twice as big as the others that died. Who knows how old that thing was. There was a big white oak right by the parking lot in the main area of the park there at the headquarters area. 4 feet in diameter. And so in West Virginia, white oaks generally you can go a foot in diameter is going to be about 100 years. So you're
really,
yeah. So you talk of, if you got a 4 foot diameter white oak, they're fairly slow growing. You can be assured it's getting up there in the 400 year old range.
Wow.
So that particular one, I think, it died. We had a big derecho storm in 2012, and the soil there is very shallow. There's a 30-foot layer of sandstone and then just 12 or less inches of soil on top of it, most of the top of the mountain there. That's why it's shaped like it is. It's just like icing on top of the cake and just a little bit of soil. And so that derecho storm was unusual winds that twisted one way, then twisted the other way, and it shook a lot of the big oaks that were in the park and I guess loosened their roots. They didn't fall down. But over the next couple years, most of the bigger oaks died, including that one. And it was its limbs were falling in the parking lot on cars and stuff, so we had to cut it down. And it was, I think it started growing something like 1670 or something, you know. So.
That is so mind-blowing.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a beautiful tree. I'd walk there and just see the big hole in the canopy of the woods and think, oh, it's gone. But I did take two of the main logs of it and sawed them up into lumber and, you know, made stuff out of them, mostly trim work and, you know, back at the park and here.
So some of it's in the house right now?
All these boards, all these trim boards on the whole house around the windows and doors are all from that tree. It was 4 feet in diameter. I couldn't move it, so we had to took chainsaws and cut slots in the end of it vertically and then along the top and then drove wedges in, split it in half, and then split the halves into quarters, same way with wedges. And then I could handle the, you know, the quarter sections. So I sawed those into one-inch lumber. That's what made all the trim from. I quarter sawed it all so you could see the rays. Really cool. That one right there, a windowsill, is it's 8 inches wide, and I think it has 164 growth rings in it. Yeah, that's a beautiful tree. I hated to see it die.
When living, you know, the place that we live in, it was made kind of like by a guy kind of like you. You made your own house. So did the past owner, it was their vacation place and he built it. So it's a ton of wood like this. And there's something so calming about living inside of a wood dwelling. And I mean, it probably reaches back into our ancient history of living in some kind of wood or reed shelter, you know?
Yeah, that tree was particularly interesting sawing up because, you know, it was, there were Indians here when it was growing, you know, still. And then, of course, it was an old tree, a large tree, when the Civil War battle was fought there at the park in November 6, 1863. And I'm sure that there were Confederate soldiers sheltered around. In fact, not 6 feet from the tree one day, I found a little cluster of 58 caliber Confederate Gardner bullets in a space about the size of my hand, unfired in a little group, just as if they'd been dropped out of a pouch or something. And then about 2 feet away, I found another one that had teeth marks all over it, had been chewed all to pieces. And so the distinct impression I had was that a guy had been hiding behind that tree, had been hit, had fallen down to the ground, got one of his bullets out to bite on while they were working on him, trying to take care of him.
Patching him up or sawing off a leg or...
Yeah.
Oh, my God. What did you do with those artifacts?
They're at the park. Yeah. Everything I ever found is at the park.
Now, how did you find that? Were you metal detecting?
I was metal detecting there. I helped Terry Lowry for 13 years. He's a Civil War historian in Charleston, West Virginia. Has written numerous... Civil War books about Civil War activities in West Virginia. And I'd contact him soon after I came to the park because we needed a book about the battle. That was one of my charges, was to research the battle and find out. All that was there when I came was a single page with three paragraphs of mostly inaccurate information. So it had just never been seriously researched. So I contacted him, and we spent 13 years gathering up materials and to write the book about the battle called The Last Sleep. But it was a good combination because he was a serious researcher, knew how to go to archives and libraries and find backgrounds of officers and all that kind of stuff. And at the park, I had daily contact with visitors, and many of them came because they had ancestors in the battle and wanted to see the place. And so through them, we found just dozens of documents. You know, they'd tell me stuff like, well, my great-grandpa was here, and my aunt has a letter that he wrote, or somebody has a picture of him, or, you know. So we just gathered up dozens and dozens of documents that way over the years, you know, with detailed stuff about the battle. And, of course, we did a lot of... metal detecting, not just on the park, but a whole general region, trying to locate on the ground where things had actually happened. Like, we were able to find most of the Confederate artillery positions, you know, right where the guns sat by the friction primers, the little copper tube about 3 inches long, filled with gunpowder, one end sealed off with wax, and the top piece had a little cross piece with a twisted wire in it with a loop. That twisted wire was coated with a chemical like the head of a kitchen match. So when you loaded the gun, you put the bag of powder in, put the shell in the barrel over top of it, took a large needle, ran it through the vent hole to poke a hole in the powder bag. Then you put this friction primer in the vent hole and held it down. It had a thing called a thumb stall. It just looked like a spoon with a leather pad. You held it on your thumb and held that down, hooked a lanyard to it, and then when the gunner pulled the cord, of course, that lit the fuse, which fired into the cannon powder and fired the gun off. Well, the ball came out the barrel, and the friction primer shot out of the vent up into the air and landed somewhere there in the near vicinity of the gun. So by finding those friction primers, we were locate, you know, pretty precisely where most of the Confederate artillery were.
That is so incredible that you've got to take part in this kind of archaeological work.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Is it kind of like, you know, I've only kind of in the past few years gotten into muzzle loading. Is it kind of like the percussion cap?
Yes, it's the same kind of thing, except it's not percussion. It's it's like striking, you know, the wooden matches you can strike anywhere.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a loop of wire and the two ends were twisted together for a space of about an inch and a half and coated with that, whatever that is on the end of the phosphorus or something on the end of the match. And so that when you jerked it out, it was just like striking a match. In fact, they came in a little paper folder, just like a book of paper matches, you know, that you used to see all the time. You unfolded the thing and pulled one out, stuck it in the vent. We were looking for some down at Mill Point because in leading up to the battle at Droop up on the mountain, there was a small skirmish at Mill Point, 7 miles to the north, the day before. Colonel William L. Jackson, cousin to Thomas or Stonewall Jackson, everybody's heard of. Everybody called him Mudwall Jackson back then because I guess he wasn't quite the general that his cousin was. But anyhow, he had a group of Confederates, about 750 men, scattered all through Pocahontas County. And when General William Averill of the Union Army was coming down through, Jackson's men fell back in front of him and tried to hold at Mill Point. Averill had maybe 4,300 men, so he was, you know, vastly outnumbered Jackson men. But, you know, that army is spread out for 4 or 5 miles, you know, on the dirt road. I mean, it took some effort to get them all together in one place where you could actually fight the battle. So Jackson held off the advance elements of Averill's army at Mill Point that afternoon leading up to the battle, trying to keep him as far away from Lewisburg, which was Confederate headquarters in the state at the time. But anyhow, we wanted to locate Jackson's guns. He had 2 12-pound howitzers, brass howitzers. Fired a round ball about 4.5 inches in diameter. And his report said, you know, they were on a hill south of Mill Point, so we get out the topo map and, well, it's probably that hill right there. And so we called the man that owned the land, went down there. He gave us permission to go down and look. We got up on top of the hill, and I turned on my detector. I was new to it, and I hadn't done it as much as my buddies who had been in it for several years. Turned mine on, and I got a signal right where I was standing. And they came over with their detectors and checked it out. And they said, well, it's not a bullet or cannon shell fragment or anything. It's some little thing like a nail or a piece of wire or something. I said, well, you know, it's in the right place. I'm going to dig it anyhow. Well, it was a friction primer. I had walked right to one of the spots where the cannon was, found 5 more there, and then a 6th one that still had part of the wire in it. The guy must have pulled it out, go to put it in the cannon, probably fumbled it and dropped it down in the grass or something, and rather than bend down in the middle of the battle and try to look for it, just got another one out. So that was really interesting. We found a lot of information.
So you found the position, the cannon.
Oh yeah,
position.
Yeah. We know that cannon was right there.
Wow,
right there at that spot.
Now I don't know very much about the Civil War. My family has shown up in America. My mom moved here from Belgium. My dad came here from England. So I don't have like this ancestral connection to the Civil War. I do find it fascinating. But for someone listening who also might not know too much, so what was, you're saying Lewisburg was the Confederates. Was West Virginia on the Union side?
There was no West Virginia at the beginning of the war. The state of Virginia extended from the Atlantic Ocean to the Ohio River.
And didn't they break off because of the Civil War?
It was roughly divided into 2 parts by the Appalachian Mountains. And the east of the mountains had been settled very early, mostly by people of English descent. Mm-hmm. Pretty civilized, sophisticated way of life. West of the mountains was not settled much until much later, mostly by Scotch, Irish, and German immigrants. And a lot of those people just, you know, they were from mountainous places, and so they moved into the mountain country, set up little settlements and little farms and stuff. And they were of a very different outlook than the settlers east of the mountain. And there had always been kind of divide. They always felt unfairly represented in the Virginia government when the Civil War broke out. Of course, particularly along the Ohio River, there was a lot of feeling that, you know, they were not part of the big Virginia planters with slaves and all that, and they saw it as an opportunity to break away. So during the war, the state of West Virginia was formed, though June 20, 1863, it was admitted into the Union as the 35th state, the only state ever formed from one dividing in two. It was a little unusual. But anyhow, even though it was a new state, was formed, large portions of it were still controlled by the Confederate Army and peopled by Confederate-minded citizens. West Virginia gave a higher proportion of its population to the armies of both sides than any other state in the Union because, you know, he had lots of Confederates, he had lots of Union in the same place. Many of the men knew each other. The new state was formed. Large portions of it, like I said, were still controlled by the Confederate Army and people by Confederate-minded citizens. The Jones-Imboden raid was made just before, in April of 1863, just before the state was formed in June. They made a big romp all through the state of West Virginia, trying to gather recruits for the Confederate Army, capturing cattle and horses and such like that, and destroying operations along the B&O Railroad. The Baltimore and Ohio Railroad was the first railroad across the Appalachian Mountains, and it connected Washington, D.C., the East Coast, with the Ohio River country and regions west of that. And so it was, you know, a tremendously important travel route. And paralleling it to the south was the Virginia-Tennessee Railroad, which followed kind of southeasterly from the coast down into Tennessee, which was controlled by the Confederates. So basically everything that happened in West Virginia during the war was a result of the Confederates trying to mess up the B&O Railroad or the Union Army trying to reach the Virginia-Tennessee, because both of them were major supply lines. Back then, if you wanted to move an army from one place to another, the railroads were the only way you could do it very quickly, and there were only two, you know, in this part of the country. Otherwise, you just had to put your men on the ground and walk them where they needed to go. It took a lot of time. And that's how they supplied them, too. So anyhow, after the new state was formed and the Confederates had shown that they could easily move throughout the whole state and destroying bridges on the B&O and stuff like that, it didn't look good. So they sent a new man to West Virginia to be in charge of the Union troops, General William Averill, and through a series of three raids in the fall and winter of 1863, he did push Confederate Army out of the new state of West Virginia. Three battles, one in August at White Sulphur Springs, one in November at Droop Mountain, which drove them out of Lewisburg and on down into Virginia, and then a third one in December, where he actually pushed all the way to the Virginia-Tennessee Railroad down in southwestern Virginia and tore up 16 miles of the railroad and escaped back safely to his headquarters in West Virginia. And fighting in 1864 moved east over into the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. And so, as it turned out, that battle at Droop Mountain was really the last significant one in West Virginia.
Really? And this is the one that you were the superintendent of the park?
Yes, yes. It's the oldest park in West Virginia, the very first one established. Men who fought there as they were getting older in the 1920s wanted it to be remembered. And so put a bill before the West Virginia legislature, and the place was purchased, property was purchased there, and veterans started developing it, putting up signs and stuff, show where things happened. And then a CCC camp was put there in 1935. That was 1928. It purchased in 1927, dedicated in July 4th, 1928, the park was. So West Virginia's first state park, though it was not fully developed. until 1935 when the CCC set up a camp there. They built a lookout tower and hiking trails, picnic grounds, and all that sort of stuff.
And the CCC, I think I first heard of when I was watching Ken Burns' documentaries about the National Parks of America.
Yes.
So isn't that the CCC was during the Depression that yes. all these young men were being hired by the government to create all these state parks, national yes. parks?
Yes, it was a movement all over the country. They took young men who had very little education and little opportunity for work and gave them both training and productive work on state and federally owned areas. And those men knew that they were doing good work that would be there for a long time. I talked to many of them when I was at Droop, when I first got there, particularly. I was interested in that history, too, and so I had interviewed dozens of those guys, mostly in their 80s and 90s by that time, telling me their experiences in the camp there at the park. And to a man, they said it was the best thing ever happened to them because, you know, they had very little opportunity. And there they were in the camp, had good food, had regular pay. They made $30 a month. They got five of it, and 25 was sent back home to their families, which they could use to buy groceries and other stuff to get them through the Depression.
Wow.
So it was a really, really good program. And another benefit of it was that when World War II came along in the 1940s, then they had a pool of men already trained because the CCC was run by regular U.S. Army officers. And it was very much like being in boot camp for the Army. You know, they played reveille in the morning. You got up when you were supposed to. You got your assignments. You did your work during the day. You took your training courses, ate at regular hours. And so it was very, very regimented and very organized.
And what exactly were they doing? Like, were they blazing trails and making roadways and infrastructure? Like, what were they doing?
The ones at Droop, of course, they were developing, some of them were developing the park, but others were doing forest improvement. The virgin timber had all been cut off. There were a lot of big fires through the 1920s and 1930s. A lot of the land was devastated, so they were going in and planting trees and building roads and doing all kinds of things, to benefit the forest. They had a little newsletter called the Cannonball at the park, and all the guys told me about it. It took me years to find the first copy. A lady in Maryland had one in a trunk. She sent a copy of it to me. They did it about every 2 weeks, all the little happenings in the camp and little biographies of the guys and what projects they was working on, that sort of stuff. And eventually, Terry Lowry, again, told me that there were a lot of CC stuff in National Archives in Washington, D.C. So through that, I was able to get a microfilm of all the cannonballs. It's like 250 pages of the daily activities of the guys in the camp at Droop. It lasted from the spring of 1935 to the fall of 1937. So about 2.5 years the camp was there. About 300 men altogether through that time there.
Were they from all over America?
They were mostly from all over the state, but there were some out-of-staters too, but it was mostly from West Virginia. But they were, spread widely over the state. There were camps all over. There was a couple down at Watoga. There's one at Seneca, over at Cranberry. It brought a lot of young men into the area, and they accomplished a lot. It's just, every one of them told me it's the best thing ever happened to them.
It seems like a good thing to bring back in our modern era. I mean, I remember was I in middle school or high school? But I went on, like, I don't really consider myself religious church-wise anymore. I definitely am spiritual, but not to a certain sect.
Uh-huh.
But in middle school or high school, I think it's probably middle school, I went on with my Presbyterian church to do like a, I don't know what you would call it, but we were volunteering. And we went to upstate New York and we helped some lady who lived in a trailer with like a paralyzed kid, and they needed like a porch built. And so me and these other kids with a few older leaders, we built this deck. And like, I still look back on that being like, that was so awesome.
Yeah.
And so I can see that it would be really beneficial to bring something back like that.
Yeah. Yeah. These guys, they came back to see the park. I mean, they were thrilled. Mm. I had a photo there taken in March of 1936. At that time, there were 159 men in the camp, you know, all lined out in front of one of the barracks. And so I numbered them. And as I talked to those guys, I'd have them look at the picture and find themselves and anybody else they knew. So over the years, I was able to get names and stories about, I don't know, probably 140 of those 159 men in the photo. So that was really cool.
Wow.
Yeah, because I would look a guy, they'd point to some guy, and I would look on my list and see if I had him. And if I did, I'd often have little stories that other guys had told me about him, you know. And so, and that would remind them of stories. And so a lot of really good interaction with those guys.
So when going back a little bit to the Civil War, I went last year, I went with my fiance and my mom and stepdad. We went to a Civil War reenactment, and I've never gone to one of those before. And to be very honest, as a kid, I would have found that kind of like a little cheesy, but today, now, I found it very profound. Mm-hmm. A lot of people there were like what you were saying, they had ancestral connections to what was going on. And I've got a lot of kind of wilder ideas. It almost was incredibly haunting because, you know, I believe in ghosts. I am very intrigued by the idea of past lives. And I was almost wondering if these people here on the field in the horses reenacting this play by play, every location, firing cannons, if these are the reincarnations of the people reliving, you know, what must have been horrifically traumatic, but living it out kind of in a much more healing way in many ways. You know, no one's dying. It's a reenactment,
right.
but they're playing it out again.
Right.
And so I did ask you about ghost stories and stuff like that. So I just wonder, like, do you have any like really profound or hair-raising or harrowing or haunting experiences from people coming to tell you their stories or anything like that? Or weird things that have happened while you worked there?
We had many, many folks that came, you know, for that reason, you know, interested in paranormal type things. And of course we had reenactors there and living histories. One thing I'd just like to say about them, you know, while we're not really glorifying war, you know, it was a horrible time for the people. And yet, you know, you gotta honor what they did. There's nothing like standing there on the ground and having a horse with a mounted man on top of it with all the sabers rattling and the clanking and, you know, big old living thing running up to you. It's not like reading about some guy and a horse, you know, fighting in the battle. But when you're right there with it, seeing it, smelling the smoke and hearing the noise, you can get a better feeling what it really was like. And so for that sense, I thought it was a good thing to do. And many of those reenactors had stories, the things that happened to them. There were numerous stories of horses. I know one I can think of right off, a fella came in early to camp, set up before the reenactment, a couple days before, and he went down to the toilets there in the evening, and there was a horse just standing there unattended. And he just thought that was odd because there weren't hardly anybody there yet. And so, you know, he went around and went and come back to his camp and asked me about it the next morning because, you know, I did my patrols through, you know, numerous times a day, checking on things, make sure everybody had what they needed and that sort of stuff. And there had been no horses there. There weren't any horses there until 2 days later. And yet, he swears he saw that horse there. I had numerous people coming out. Like one guy came out of the museum one day and come running down all in a rush into my office and said, "You got to come out here and see this." And so I come out and by the graves behind the office, he said he had been coming out of the museum door. It's a little log cabin we got just out from the graves. And there was somebody standing there leaning against one of the trees like he was really tired, dressed up like a soldier. He thought it was a reenactor because we had living histories and people were there dressed up like soldiers lots of times. Not at this day, but at other times. So he thought that's what it was. But the way the guy was acting, he thought it was odd because he looked so tired. And so he hollered his wife, "Come out here and look at that." And when she came out, then all at once the guy wasn't there no more. So he come down, dragged me, and said he was right here. But, you know, I didn't see him. I just, not the right kind of guy, I guess. But we had people bring recorders, and they would have garbled messages, audio messages, pictures of orbs of all different colors at different places. I remember one lady, we walked around for several hours one day taking pictures. You know, we'd walked all over the battlefield for several hours. Something happened here, something happened there, you know, that I knew about in other places. I didn't know. I had no idea. But she just took pictures randomly all through the day. And then later came back with the pictures developed, and she'd show them to me. And what do I see? And, well, first I'd see rocks and trees and, you know, not really anything. And then all at once I could see in this one, plain as day, it was a silhouette under a leafy branch of a man kneeling with one knee up and another leg down. And you could see clearly the profile of his face, the nose, the lips, his hat, gun barrel coming up across the knee, like he was watching out into right where that main part of the battle had been fought there in the front lawn. And that all could have been shadows and stuff, but very clearly right there where his shoulder would have been were three yellow chevrons, just like the shoulder stripes. I'm plain as day. I don't know. We didn't see anything when we were there, but in the photo, there was something there.
Wow. At that Civil War reenactment that I went to last year, I do some black and white photography on super grainy film. And I did have some strange, I don't know what to make of them. I'm not jumping to any conclusions, but I certainly, on a few of the pictures, you know, you see all the cavalcade, all the guys on horses and stuff. And I've got some strange kind of, almost what seemed like kind of like shooting stars, like streaks of these, of light across the top. So I just kind of wonder about that stuff.
Yeah, well, I didn't have any real experiences of my own. I'm just not, I don't know. I just not in tune with it, I guess. I don't know. But I've talked to enough other people that, you know, they saw stuff, they believed, and I can't question that. Many of the past park superintendents had all kinds of stories. I know Nap Holbrook, Napoleon Holbrook, he was superintendent at the park from 1946 to 1949. He had two children, a boy and a girl, and they were there, I say, almost 3 years. And they had all kinds of experiences. His wife one day was in the backyard of the house there, the residence on the park, stringing beans just a, you know, an afternoon in the early fall. And heard somebody coming, walking through the leaves, crunch, 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 and looked up, but nobody was there. And then all at once when they got down to the, there's some stone sidewalk there, flagstone sidewalk. All at once, there was a sound of boots on stones instead of leaves, but so there was nothing there. And then it went across over to the cellar house, a little stone cellar there. And she said she clearly saw the padlock move, you know, which, you know, they don't do that. But she She saw it, she says. So, and her boy, he was the best. He, but the girl too, they all had stories. But the boy, I had not met him. Knapp came, Napoleon, came to visit up into his 90s. Every time he was in Pocahontas County, he'd come by and visit me and tell me stories about when they were there and that kind of stuff. And it was just great. We got to be really good friends. But his boy I had never met until Knapp died, and I went to the funeral in Northern Panhandle where they lived. And there I met the boy for the first time, and I'd heard the story from other people, but I finally got it from him. This is like 60 years after they'd been there. He told the story that one day he went out with his dad in the park truck going around gathering litter and just doing whatever his dad was, taking care of his daily duties. And when they got back to the house, parked right in front of the house, and Knapp went inside, and the boy, he had a little toy car, and he was just playing with it in the truck, and he was having fun, so he just continued sitting there in the truck for a little while, playing with his car, running it on the dashboard, and not really paying much attention to anything. And all at once, he heard a horse coming, just ka-clump, 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 running up towards the truck. So he looked out the window, and nothing there. And he thought, well, he must have just forgot about it. You know, he's telling me this like 60 years later. And so anyhow, this horse comes running across there, and he doesn't see anything. So he forgets about it and goes back to play, and he just, nothing there. He just thought he'd just imagined it. And said all at once, clap, 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 ran right up to the, it was right by the door. I mean, right by the door of the truck on the pavement there. And he was looking right out the open window, and nothing there, nothing there. And all at once, a horse blubbered its lips. You know how they make, you know, noise. And he said it just blew the hair right up off his forehead. And he could just practically feel the slobbers right in his face. And, of course, was terrorized, starts screaming and crying. Everybody runs out of the house to see what's the matter. And it was 3 or 4 days before they could get him to come down the steps there and not cry, because it scared him so bad. And they moved. His dad got a job at a different park just a couple months after that. And at the funeral, the boy was telling me, you know, he had never been back to that place. He's never so glad to leave a place in his life as when he left Droop Mountain Battlefield. And he had never gone back, and he was never coming back, because still, 60 years later, he'd wake up at night sometimes, having had the dream of that horse blowing in his face, all terrorized, just like he'd been when he was a little boy. So whatever happened to him lasted his entire life. You know, so I mean, how can you argue with that?
Oh, I love that. A phantasmal horse.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah,
that.
There's a lot of stuff like that. People yelling halt, all kinds of screams. I know another superintendent, Bill Davis, one time they were working out there raking leaves and heard somebody scream just like they were being killed, just right off the edge of the lawn there. And so that they stopped work. All had 5 or 6 guys working. They had a big program that summer, and so he had several workers. They spent the whole afternoon looking to find out what had happened to somebody. Nothing there, but they all heard it clearly. Somebody screaming just like they were dying, yet nobody was there.
So, jeez.
Things like that were very common there. When we wrote the book about the battle, I had a whole collection of them, you know, dozens of those kind of stories. We made a whole chapter of the book, and some of the ghosts of Droop Mountain, pretty cool.
That's great. Well, thank you for sharing all that. Now, I guess, was there anything else of archaeological importance that you guys found? So you found those primers, and you found...
Found a bayonet
the
one
bullets.
Day.
A bayonet, wow. Also on the at Droop?
Yeah, there was...
And when how deep are these things when you're
typically,
pulling them?
Typically, they're not real deep. 3 to 5 inches, generally.
Really? Okay.
A cannon shell, a whole shell, might be deeper. But generally, they're not all that deep. Occasionally, a tree will fall over. And of course, like I said earlier, there's not much soil there, so often the bedrock is exposed when a tree falls over because it's loosely attached to the top of it. And several times I have found bullets on the ground under where a tree uprooted. Found them in old chestnut stumps. There were several guns found, or not several. I can think of at least two were found while I was there, maybe three. But two of them, one of them, three boys came in one day. They'd been going down the side of the mountain about a mile south of the park because, you know, the top of the mountain is level for about 5 miles, but only a couple hundred yards wide, just long and straight. And the highway, of course, goes right along that top. And they had gone down a side ravine down over the hill, and one of them found a piece of metal there in a little deep ravine halfway down the mountain in the woods and thought it was a piece of pipe and pulled it out and was just about to wrap it around a tree because they were just, you know, throwing sticks and rocks and being boys. And there and hollered and said, "Hey, it looks like a gun." So they brought it back to me, you know, less than an hour after they'd found it. They wanted to see if it was a real Civil War gun. Well, it was. It was a Confederate Sharps carbine. You could tell by the brass barrel band. The wood of the stock was rotted away, but there was a small piece of wood under that barrel band. And, of course, that meant that generally on the Sharps of the Union manufacturer were made out of steel or iron. And the Confederates, they didn't have the manufacturing capabilities north, so they made a lot more stuff out of brass because it was easier to handle. And so that's what it was. It was Confederate Sharps carbine. Well, of course, I wanted to see the spot where it came from. And so I went back with them and took a metal detector. And you could clearly see the imprint of the gun. It was a real steep ravine, and it's just a tiny stream, just less than a foot wide, coming down off the hill there, and it had made a little floodplain, a little flat place, maybe 2 or 3 feet wide and 6 or 8 feet long, where it made a little swirl in the bottom of the thing, in the bottom of the ravine, and the creek had cut through under part of the barrel, which exposed it. That's what they saw. And then when they picked it up, it left an imprint. Well, I searched the general area there, and about 6 inches from the gun, found a gold wedding ring. At first, I thought it was a nickel because it was about the size, but it was thicker than a coin. But when I got to looking at it and poked at it, I realized that was just dirt that was in the middle, and it was actually a wedding band. It was a brass ring lined with gold. And that was a very common wedding band at that time because it was cheaper. But then you having the gold on the inside of the ring, then you didn't get a green ring around from wearing a brass ring on your finger because it would corrode and make it green. So very likely, and again, just like the bullets by the big oak tree, you know, you get an impression from when you're there. Here's this gun laying there. Here's a wedding ring 6 inches from it. And you can't help but think, here's a Confederate running down the side of the mountain trying to get away, very likely wounded, and probably just dies right there on that spot in that ravine. And everything is gone except the gun and the ring.
I mean, that's as haunting as it gets. You think no one even salvaged the guy?
We know.
I mean, if the ring is there, that's very, very odd.
Yeah, very odd. Very odd. I mean, it's not super odd to find wedding rings on battlefields because you get any kind of wound in your shoulder or arm, that ring needs to come off because if your fingers swell, then it's going to cut off the circulation to that finger.
Okay.
You know, so it's not uncommon to find wedding rings, but that one being right by the gun,
yeah,
made me really feel that probably that's what happened. Of course, we had many accounts.
Now, wait, did you kind of try to excavate that area and see if you found human remains or anything?
No, we didn't dig.
That's what I mean.
Other than we just metal detected. But any bones that would have been on the surface would have been long gone. We have many accounts during the retreat, which was chaotic. The Confederate Army, most of them had come up from Lewisburg during the night, 30 miles, walked all night to support Jackson. He had fallen back from Mill Point and took defensive positions on top of Droop Mountain because it was the right place to be. If you're going toward Lewisburg, you had to go over Droop Mountain. And so he got the high ground. Then during the night, he was reinforced by General Echols till there were about 2,500 Confederates there. Of course, most of them had walked all night from Lewisburg. Then they fought all day, walked all night back to Lewisburg, and all day the next day on down into Virginia. So they traveled almost 100 miles in 2 days and a night. You know, so many of the men couldn't keep up, and there's all kinds of accounts of men running off the sides of the mountain, going down, sometimes guns tumbling end over end. You know, they're just trying to get out of there, get out of the way of the Union Army, and escape. And so, you know, that fit right in with what we found there. I mean, it just made sense.
Wow. Wow. Well, I think we've talked about that, the Civil War and Droop, for a good chunk there. And I found that all very fascinating. Let's turn the page back even more. How about, have you found Native American artifacts out here? From the little reading I've done, and please tell me if this is not accurate to I guess, the archaeology of today. But from the little reading I've done about this general area, it seems as though this was not necessarily a permanent living area, that this was probably like seasonal hunting grounds. Please tell me if there's different ideas on this.
You hear that a lot, and I'm sure it was true when the white people first came here. No doubt in my mind. You know, the white man's diseases had preceded them. And many areas where Indians had lived had been vacated. But beyond that, prior to that, way back, there's clearly were people that lived here. The mound builders back, Fort Ancient people, paleo people. We found stuff not just at the park. Every place I've lived in West Virginia, I've found artifacts. From natives that were there. There's no doubt in my mind they lived there. Out by the flagpole at the park, there was a place that my boy Caleb just insisted that some guy sat there making arrowheads for years because there were just all these flakes in that one spot that, you know, were constantly coming up out of the ground. And numerous arrowheads. We found any time a tree turned over, or blew over, or we were digging holes to put posts in the ground, stuff like that. It was not uncommon to find arrowheads of all kinds, scrapers, pieces that had been worked.
Scrapers was for the hide work?
Yeah. I know coming up to the front porch of the park residence where we lived for 32 years, raised my kids there. You know, there was a couple stepping stones close together with a little patch of grass, and often that grass would get wore away and it'd just be dirt between the stones. And one day I saw a little glimmer, looked like flint, and scratched it. And there was a point that was, 3 inches long, and just a big triangular point. That we'd been walking over for years and years and years, you know, right there between the stepping stones. There's lots of that. The oldest one we found, one day I had been at Dolly Sod's up in Randolph County picking blueberries.
It's incredible up there.
Oh, yeah, I loved it. We went to Dolly Sod's every year.
That's a magical spot.
Pick wild blueberries and huckleberries. And that's what we'd done. We'd gone up there and picked berries all day and come back in the evening. during the day, Jim Cloonan, that worked with me at the park, had been putting in posts. We were replacing all the signposts in the park, some 100 signs, you know, so there's a lot of digging posts and stuff. And he had dug two post holes for interpretive sign that we wanted to put on the edge of the lawn down there just below our mailbox. So when I come in, of course, I have my bow with me, and I was coming out of the car, and I saw the two dirt piles where he had dug the post holes but hadn't put the posts in yet. And so, well, I just, you know, I like to shoot arrows, so I winged an arrow down toward the dirt pile and stuck right in it, walked down to get it, and when I was probably 15 feet away, there was the arrow stuck in dirt pile. I could see a big old arrowhead just like right beside the arrow, within a couple inches. And so I went and picked it up, and it was a real unusual arrowhead because it was made out of some kind of gray and almost blue streaky flint that was not the normal flint that's around here. You know, there's a place down at Mill Point, 7 miles away, called the Flint Pits, where Indians, you can see like craters in the moon, where they dug holes getting flint nodules to make arrow points. But this was not that local flint. It was from somewhere else, somewhere far away. So I took that particular point to Hunter Lesser, who is an archaeologist for the Monongahela National Forest. And he looked it over, because I'd looked at some charts and stuff, and just, but I'm, you know, I'm not an expert, but he knew about them. He said, you know, that point was right at 10,000 years old.
Yeah. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. So, yeah, 8,000 BC.
And was he able to pinpoint where it came from? Would it have?
No, I don't know where that particular flint source was from, but I've found obsidian points. I've found points that we know the source was in Ohio. Mm-hmm. You know, most of them are local. A lot of them are Kanawha Black Flint down in the Kanawha Valley, but most of the ones around here are the local limestone flint nodules. You know, there's a lot of limestone here all through Greenbrier, Pocahontas County, and in that limestone, these nodules form anywhere from marble size up to softball or even soccer ball size. I guess there's voids in the sediments and fine material fits in. They form kind of like geodes. They're crusty on the outside. Then there's a nice layer of flint, and in the center will often be like quartz crystals, kind of like a geode. You bust them open and make the points out of the good flint part.
I mean, I would love to check out those flint pits sometime. That sounds pretty spectacular.
Yeah, down at Mill Point.
Now, is it known, the more recent Native Americans that were here, is it known what tribe affiliations they were? Is it Seneca? Or I know there's Seneca Rocks about 2 hours
right
from here. Is it?
Right. The Shawnees.
Okay.
They didn't live here. They lived along the Ohio River. But
in present day West Virginia, along the Ohio River?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, on the other side of the river were their main towns. Okay. Cincinnati, that area.
Okay.
Well, all over Ohio. But they frequently traveled into the mountains over here, and many of the conflicts between the early settlers in this region and the Indians were with the Shawnees.
Gotcha.
They had moved around. They'd been pushed south. They'd moved numerous places, but at the time of the European settlement, they were in Ohio country. The Mingos, supposedly here in the northern part of the town, they were not as much a tribe as they were a group of, I won't call them outcasts, but they were a conglomeration of other tribes, that had got together there. Of course, the Cherokees from south came up into this country.
They came all the way up here?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the 219, the main highway through Pocahontas County, was part of the Great Warrior Path, traveling along the Appalachians from the Carolinas, you know, up into New England. I mean, that's why the road's there. Most of the roads, that we have now are, were originally Indian paths. It wasn't a trackless wilderness when white people came. Mm-hmm. There were long established travel ways, mostly along the rivers, but, through the mountains too.
Man, that's incredible. Let's keep turning the pages back.
Okay.
So we did Civil War, we did Native Americans. Now let's go from archaeology to paleontology. Let's talk about fossils or old bones or anything like that.
Yes.
I mean, to me, finding a fossil is almost like an existential psychedelic experience. It disturbs me. Like, because I'll be 3,000 feet up one of these mountains and find a clump of seashell trace fossils. And it's like, this was an ocean. It's like really, it's so intense to kind of contemplate that it's like.
You can go out to Beartown State Park, which I also took care of, just beyond the park on private land, just on the other side of the park, which is the.
But is it open for the public to visit? Beartown?
Beartown is, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But not the spot you're talking about?
No.
Okay.
No, but I often took people there.
Gotcha.
School groups and such like that for years and years and years because I knew the people and they didn't mind them going out there. And I still do that. In fact, I go back every year. And there's some road cut out there, just a little log road where the shales are exposed. And you can just pick fossil seashells right off the top of the mountain. I mean, they weather out their cast of the seashells.
Yeah, the trace fossil, I think is the word.
Yeah, yeah. The shell itself has dissolved away, but then the shape of it is clearly reproduced.
It's like a stamp in the sediment.
Yes. Yeah, but, you can get whole seashells. And we found all three or four types of brachiopods, polysipods, horn corals.
Are those all the scalloped looking shell? Is that what the proper term is for them?
Yeah. So the polysipods and the brachiopods are oriented a little different.
Okay.
Some of them have heavy grooves. Some of them are smooth. Some of them have fine grooves and kind of a buffalo hump shoulder. Lots of those there. We find occasional horn corals, which looks like a horn of plenty, for Thanksgiving, the little basket with the fruit in it.
The cornucopia thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they look just like that, but they're small. Found a few trilobites, all right there on the tip top of the mountain. So, and then there's the big layer of the Droop sandstone. Which is the rocks of Beartown. The whole top of the mountain is covered with layer of sandstone, just like icing on top of a cake. And underneath are softer shales, mudstones, limestones that weather away faster than the sandstone cap. And so that has taken some of the support out from beneath that. It's kind of like you had cake with icing on. You start digging out crumbs, the icing's going to sag down and fall. And that's what's happened at Beartown. As you get further out, the big chunks of rock get farther and farther away as gravity pulls them down the hill. So they're just fracture cracks.
Now, these fossils that you're talking about, this general region, what period is it? Is it Devonian?
It's not that old. It's Mississippian, Pennsylvanian, 350, 400 million years ago.
Wow.
To get to Devonian shales and some of those older ones, you've got to cross the Greenbrier River. It's like the dividing line.
Okay.
So the rocks over at Watoga are very different from the rocks right here, of just a few miles away on the other side of the river.
I still don't understand this part. So we've found some incredible fossils in the Chesapeake Bay. They're Miocene, so 5 to 20 million years. Why is it different ages in different places? Is it that the what has worn away of the earth? That
exactly.
Okay.
Where we are on the east side of the middle, Africa and North America started colliding and made the Appalachian Mountains, you've got the coastal plain, and then you've got the Piedmont, and then you've got the ridge and valleys,
yes.
The big wrinkles,
yes.
Where the mountains were pushed up, and then the sediments were actually folded. Well, west of there, where we are in the highlands, they didn't fold; they just bulged high upward.
Okay.
And then the stuff on top is where, that's why you don't find dinosaur fossils and stuff like that here, because all that's weathered away. It's all washed away down the rivers to somewhere else.
So the deepest stuff got pushed to the top.
Yes.
And then just natural weathering has given us that period is what we can find here.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
The basement rock here is like 18, 20,000 feet deep. You know, you've got sedimentary rock down. You know, so all that has piled in from these huge mountains weathering away. Mm. Supposedly, they were higher than the Appalachians were higher than the Himalayas.
I've heard that. And
when they were formed. But, you know, now they're just the stubs, the roots of what they once were.
Oh, well, that's beautiful. The roots of the mountains.
Yeah.
And I've heard Appalachia is one of the oldest chains on Earth, if not the oldest. It's one of.
It's a world-class area for salamanders. Interesting, because, you know, they've just been here a long time, and stuff has had time to develop.
Yeah, I've done a few episodes with herpetologists talking about different salamanders. What were you going to say?
I was going to say another interesting fossil here is the Lystrinella.
Okay, what's that?
Lystrinella is a fossilized coral.
Okay.
It forms in big cauliflower-like heads, very common in the Greenbrier limestone, which underlays all this area of Hillsborough and you know, southern Pocahontas, Greenbrier County. Some of it's pinkish, some of it's blue. It's actually a state rock of West Virginia. A few years back.
Our mutual friend, Bryn, she came over and gave us a fossil, and I think that's exactly what it was. It was a piece of that.
Yeah. Yeah. A full one will look just like a big head of cauliflower.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why I say that I feel like finding a fossil is so psychedelic is because the first real significant ones we found, we went on a little trip to the Chesapeake Bay like 4 years ago or three springs ago. And my fiance Vivian, there's a area called the Calvert Cliffs where there's a lot of erosion.
Oh yeah, I know the Calvert Cliffs.
Yes, and a lot of people go there trying to find
shark teeth.
Yeah,
yeah. My wife has found them there.
Nice. Yeah, megalodon teeth and stuff like that. Anyways, Vivian has always, as a little girl, was very inspired by like Tomb Raider and Indiana Jones, and she loves all that. So there she is in her, we got in waders so we could really go far along the coastline there in the bay. But Vivian is, you know, see something in this collapsed area kind of down into the wash and into the surf. And she starts kind of like pushing away at the clay or whatever, this super thick sediment that's around it. And she found a vertebrae of a Miocene era whale, an extinct baleen whale. And she immediately said, whale, even though we're not necessarily very well versed in this,
right.
But she just felt it.
Right.
The next morning we drove to the area's museum and we actually were able to talk with a paleontologist who said that is Miocene era. So somewhere between like 5 and 18 million years old, it was a juvenile because paleontologists could see there was something with between each vertebrae, there's like there'll be a fusion with some of the bone or the cartilage between them, something like that. Uh-huh. So you could say that's juvenile, extinct, extinct species, all that kind of stuff. And I couldn't sleep that night because to me, it was like, well, humans weren't even humans then.
Right.
Right. So we were our ancient primordial ape version of humans. So here I am in this Airbnb that we're staying at. I'm like, in 5 to 20 million years, could something that evolves from our house cats or evolves from like a mink or a muskrat find my bones and it turn into some super sentient being that is housing my bones into a little building? That was so just like, so like, it really like disturbed me. I was so like shaken by the idea of finding something from so far back. It really is haunting.
Yeah.
But man, well, we've been talking for so long and it's been awesome. I love this, but we haven't even gotten into you. Like, you're this super cool guy. I mean, you love all this stuff. You've been telling this amazing history, but you've told me a bit about, you know, growing up, and, you know, I know you love hunting and, you know, working hides and stuff like that. I mean, where did you grow up? Are you a West Virginian? And did you grow up here or in another part?
I was born in Ohio.
Okay.
But my folks were from West Virginia. They were just working up there. And I was there only 2 weeks.
In Ohio. Okay.
When I was 2 weeks old, they moved back to West Virginia. And so while I technically am a Buckeye, all my life has been in West Virginia, other than those 2 weeks.
And were you, did you say once that you were in Charleston, or were you in town, or were you out in the country, or
what? We lived in Charleston. My first memory, the oldest memory I have, is when we lived in Charleston just briefly. Mom was working for the telephone company, and I remember I must have been a year and a half, 2 years old, because I could stand up, and I was standing at the door where we lived, looking through the glass, and there was a milkman coming down the sidewalk. We had a little sidewalk, and we had just a tiny little gate. And he came down, and he had this metal rack with six bottles of milk in it, glass bottles of milk, five white and one chocolate. And he came and set it on our step and then continued on down the street.
That's your
the only time I ever lived in a city, really.
Okay.
That's all I remember of that. But we grew up in the country in Clay County in third grade when I was 8 years old or so. We moved to Braxton County, where my mom still lives.
Well, one of the things you told me, I was like, that is one of the most fun stories I've heard, is you said when you were a kid, you guys would collect snapping turtles.
Yes.
But there was a whole thing to it, and you got to tell me about it. Do you remember what you said? Has to do with your swimming pool?
When we moved to Braxton County, when I went to the third grade, I was 8 years old, we moved what we thought was a mansion, because it had a basement, and it had a main floor, and it had an upstairs, and it had a big attic, and it had a creek and a pond and big culverts. And you know, we had always lived in like little shacks. I mean, literally just tar paper shacks, boards, not even with studs, just Jenny Lind type construction, where you have two boards at the bottom, horizontal and vertical boards, and then put tar paper on the outside and newspaper on the inside. That's what we were used to, and we didn't know anybody had anything different. So when we moved to Braxton County, and here was a big two-story house with a basement and a creek and a pond and culverts, and it was pretty exciting. So we thought we'd just died and go into heaven. But anyhow, that's where I grew up. Yeah.
The snapping turtles.
Oh, the snapping turtles. Okay, sorry, I got sidetracked. Yeah, in the backyard. Yeah, not only a pond, there was a cinder block swimming pool in the backyard. They just dug down in and made a swimming pool. Wow, and we'd never heard anybody that had a swimming pool. We were very excited about it. But it was at such a low level in the ground, because it was not far from the creek, that it was hard to drain it out completely. We had to have a little pumper thing that we would suck the water and then shoot it out. And, you know, we could clean it that way. But there was usually a little bit of water in the bottom of it, and it'd get pretty scuzzy where leaves got in, stuff like that. And so anyhow, my dad liked snapping turtles, you know, to eat. And so we would go to ponds, ponds all over the place. Almost everybody had a little pond somewhere. And we would put out hooks and catch snapping turtles, and we would throw them in that cinder block pool until we had, you know, 15, 20 snapping turtles. And then we'd have a big turtle killing, you know, and clean them all up and invite everybody. And, you know, local musicians and stuff would come, and we'd have a big giant turtle party. It was really, really fun. We had like over 100 people several times. It was a big excitement.
That is so cool. Now, two things. How did you bait? Did you bait your hooks? Tell me about the actual catching process.
Okay. When we wanted to catch turtles, we would take cotton cord and a big hook, you know, a 2-0, 3-0 hook, you know, inch and a half, a pretty good size hook usually, and tie it onto the cord and put a piece of bacon on it. Not, we got bacon then in a slab. It still had the skin, the rind on it, and it was real tough. And so you could punch a hole in that and run the hook through the bacon and through the rind, and you couldn't tear it off. You know, it just wouldn't come loose. And so then we just put two or three lines in a pond. You drive a stake in the ground, tie it to it, or if there was a tree there, tie it to the tree, throw that chunk of bacon out in there, and then come back the next day, and the turtles would, you know, swallow the rind, and then they would generally move over to the edge of the pond and be in the mud right there, just a couple feet from the edge of the pond. I don't know why they went to the edges, but they always did. And then you just pull the line and pull them in. And so, yeah, it wasn't hard to catch them. You know, so we would bring and put them in the pond. And when we decided to kill them and cut them up, you know, they're hard to kill. You know, they don't want to die. They really don't want to die. And, you know, you can cut their head off with an axe and, you know, they'll just run for the creek. I mean, they'll go 200 yards. I mean, I don't know whether it's the slope or the ground. They know where the water is somehow, even with their head cut off. They'll just run away. Doesn't seem to bother them that much. And so we stymied for a while how to kill them, you know, so that, you know, they'd be dead. And what we finally came up with, and it worked pretty good, was you put the turtle on the ground and step on it with both feet, with your heels at the back of the shell, and then your toes in the middle of the shell, and lean your weight forward. And that would kind of push the turtle's head out a little. You know, they couldn't, snapping turtles can't pull them all the way back in, so it's out anyhow a little bit. But that would push them, the head forward a little bit when you put your weight on the front part of the shell. And then we'd have a big 2x4. Just a big club over our head, and then just hit him right on the end of the nose, you know, just, and that would drive the head back into the body. And that generally killed them quite a lot better. I don't know, it like paralyzed their nerves or something. And because otherwise, if you just chop her head off and go to cutting on them, they'll just claw you and kick, and, you know, it's pretty awful because you feel like you're just, something's alive and you can't. It feels bad cutting it up, but anyhow, that would paralyze them, like, and you could generally cut them open, and you know, they got quite a lot of meat in it, a lot of different meat, different muscles, have different textures and colors, and supposedly like 7 or 8 different kinds of meat in a snapping turtle, but it's all really quite delicious. So we would eat them.
How did you cook them?
Typically, we would boil them until they were, you know, boil them, pour the water off, and then boil them again. When they were cooked, then Mom would bread them and fry them like chicken, you know. So, and you know, they've got the little old short leg bones and stuff and real meaty, muscly around them. And it's a little bit like chicken wings, you know. If you didn't know what you was eating, you know, you could easily be mistaken for looking like chicken. And we had several people that thought they were chicken and wouldn't eat them no more because they said, I can't eat no turtle.
Did you serve it with any sides or any sauce or anything?
Oh, there was all kinds of stuff all the time. I mean, you know, it was always garden produce, and everybody brought soups and stews and cakes. And, you know, it was just big, giant, like, potluck party, you know.
And how many turtles did it take to feed 100 people?
Well, normally, I'd like to say we would have a party when we had, you know, 15, 20 turtles. You know, so.
And was there a season for this party? Was this at the end of the summer or what?
No, it just whenever we got the urge, you know. It was usually in the fall, as I remember. I don't know why. There wasn't any particular celebration. It just, you know, we hadn't had a turtle party for a while, so we'd have one.
A turtle party. I absolutely love that. I've caught two snapping turtles. One of them was huge. And I baited it with a piece of possum meat.
Yeah.
Because I had caught a possum trapping, and I didn't really want to eat the possum. So I was like, well, let's you can use a lot of the meat as bait for trapping. So I did the same thing with the hook with a real thick piece of cord. And when we cooked that, there's like a very famous hunter guy called Hank Shaw. And he's, I think, known for doing really good recipes for a lot of wild game. And he had a recipe online for creel turtle soup. And, it's got like sherry in there. It's like a gumbo type thing.
Right, right.
It was one of the best things, not just wild game. It's one of the best things I've ever eaten.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this turtle meat is definitely one of my favorites.
Yeah, we never made soup, but that's typically how it's done. Mm-hmm. It's made into soup. If I ever bring myself to kill another one, I may try that, but I have a hard time killing them anymore, you know.
Yeah, sure.
The last one I killed, you know, it was probably as old as I was. You know, you can judge a little. The scales on their shell, you know, have annual rings. They tend to wear off over time, so it's hard to be exact. It's not exactly like tree rings, but you can get close. You know, if one has a lot of rings, it's got a lot of years, and probably a lot of those are already worn off, so it's probably older than what it looks like it is. And, you know, and this one, at the time I killed it, was probably, I was probably 55, and I could count, you know, almost that many rings on those scales. And so I felt that it was probably even older than I was, and I had a hard time with it because I was wrestling it around. It took me like 15 minutes to get it killed. But anyhow, I just felt so bad for it. And the only reason I did it was because folks had a pond, and you know the turtles had been eating the baby wood ducks in the pond, and they asked me if I'd come down and catch some of the turtles out and kill them. So I did, but I felt so bad about it. I don't know if I can do it anymore.
Yeah, no, I understand. I mean, I felt that way with the first one I caught. It was big.
Yeah,
and it we kept the shell and everything. And I mean, I had a tear in my eye after sawing it. Cutting his head off was so intense.
Yeah,
you know, it's not like shooting a squirrel from 50 yards away, you know?
Right, you're right there.
But the meat was incredible. And yeah, I know that they will eat the feet off people's. Yeah. And there's I don't think there's too much of I think the populations are healthy too.
Right? Oh yeah, there's plenty of them.
I actually, so in the general area where we are is the U Mountain Center. And I've done a bunch of work, illustration work for them. And I think one of the ladies there was telling me that they had a neighbor whose dog was eaten by a snapping turtle. Like, what? Like, I don't know about that. That sounds crazy.
We had one time that we finally got it in a wash tub, you know, a big galvanized wash tub. We finally got it in there, but it barely fit. You know, a wash tub, that's a big turtle. We put a stick, a broom handle in there. When it bit it, it broke the broom handle in half. I mean, it was that big.
Wow, monster turtle.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they're wonderful animals.
Yeah, they're amazing. All the turtles, and I love I love the little box turtles that you find in the woods. Those are they're so beautiful with the yellow.
Yeah, at my hunting camp over in Braxton County, we built a little house for little 24x24 house in 1975 when I was still in high school along the government land around Burnsville Lake, and I've hunted there ever since. And I gather up all the box turtle shells I find, you know. I've probably got 30 some there, you know, that I've picked up over the years, you know, because they're probably one of the longest lived animals in North America. And, you know, they've been known to get 135 years old.
I have a friend in this general region, and he's a miner, but he is his hunting is like he's a deep hunter. Uh-huh. And
Sorry, I've got to sneeze.
Go for it.
It won't come.
But yeah, my buddy, he's a, you know, super passionate hunter, and he made me a turkey. I guess it's the you know, the calls that have the stick.
Oh, the wing bone call.
No. It's with a stick, right? But he made the piece of slate, the slate call.
Oh, yeah.
But he put the slate into a turtle shell.
Nice.
Into a fountain.
Right, it's like a resonator.
Yeah. So I'm like, I can't wait to try that out this season.
Oh, that'll be great.
And speaking of him, I'm kind of sidetracking here, but I was telling him how much I love all the fossils. He gave me a piece of fossil that he found in the mines, and he called it horsetail. And now I'm aware of the horsetail that's around today.
Yeah.
And you see it along the creeks, and I know that it's a primordial plant species, but this is huge. So I don't know if this is like an ancient version that was an enormous version of the horsetail, but it's a fascinating little sliver of, and it's like black, you know, it's like black fossil.
Yeah. You can find those, at Sharp's Knob.
Okay.
Up, you know, a little bit north of Snowshoe. There, you know, a lot of strip mining up there.
Okay.
And we found some really nice ones up there. I know my boy or my friend Mark found one time, was, two or three inches in diameter. And, you know, it's segmented with lines, and it was the end of the root because there was the nub in and there were two segments. The whole thing was about that long.
About a foot long?
Yeah. It was broken in half. He found one half, and then later we found the other half, and they meshed together perfectly. But it was the last 12 inches or so of a root that was probably 3 inches in diameter. Mm.
That is a good find.
Yeah. There's lots of them. There's a Sigillaria that has little dots on it. Hmm. It was a big root with thin hairs that came out each of those dots, kind of like ostrich feathers. You know how ostrich skin has those dots where the feathers come out. So that was Sigillaria. Then Lepidodendron, they're kind of diamond-shaped bark. There's, you know, a lot of those. In the coal mines, you know, you could find a lot of that kind of stuff. Mm. Because that's, you know, when they were all formed.
Right. The coal is like an ancient, isn't coal the broken down of ancient vegetation?
Yeah.
It's just
vegetation that's been covered and eventually carbonized, and it's coal, turns to coal.
Right.
We used to go to the big strip mines over in Wyden in Clay County, where the auger mines, and they had these huge gob piles, they called them, and it was, just slate and shale and stuff that was not coal. And you could find all kinds of fossils in that stuff. Ferns and it's ferns that just look like photographs. So good.
Do you have some in your collection?
I do not have it. I don't know what happened to them all because I gathered them all the time when I was a kid. But somehow along the way I have lost them. I don't know what happened to them. Mm. I found a dog track one time. I don't remember. It was just we were in a little cave, like maybe 10 feet deep, an overhang really. It wasn't a cave. It was just like overhang rock with a flat place under it. And I had turned over a rock, and it was the perfect imprint of a dog or a coyote or something, just in the rock.
What?
Yeah. It just looked like it stepped in plaster of Paris. It was a triangular piece, about 12 inches to a side, and not exactly in the middle, but off to the side of that triangle, one of the edges. It was an absolute perfect dog print. But
fossilized.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, have you shown anyone that? I mean,
I didn't keep it because the guy that I was with, it was his place where we were at, and he wanted it, so I left it with him.
Oh, like you wonder, is that like a Native American dog breed, or is it a wolf? They had wolves out here.
I don't know. Wolf, would, coyote.
Well, I don't think coyotes would have been here.
I don't know what it was. It was the size and shape of a dog print.
That is
cool. So what it actually was, I don't know. But it was clearly a canid, some type of dog, whether a wolf or whatever.
That is neat.
Yeah. I hated to give it up.
I believe it. Yeah, I mean, finding stuff in the woods is always is like that's one of the coolest things.
Yeah. You
know, especially because some of the land that's now national forest would have been homesteads back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
So you'll just find like a cemetery out in the middle of the woods.
Yeah.
Pretty cool crumbling cemetery. What do you have on your notes? Is there anything in there that you really want to tell?
Oh, there's all kinds of good stories. I mean, I don't know what you're interested in. I got all kinds of animal stories and hunting stories. The pictures of me when I was a little kid, a baby, you know, here I am in the baby bed, standing up with a gun in each hand, you know, twice as tall as I am, just grinning like a fiend. Or I'm standing on the porch holding a dead possum, just grinning like a fiend, you know. And, you know, from babyhood, I was eat up with animals and the outdoors and trees and all that stuff. I mean, that's my very first book Mom got me was Field Guide to North American Mammals. And I, you know, I was just like a little feller way before I went to school. And I just loved that book, but I actually loved it to death so that, you know, it finally was gone. You know, I just wrote in it and I don't know. I just, it finally just going. Though I have some others from not too long after that. She also got me a little series of books, birds, mammals, amphibians, you know, just little pocket books. And I've still got a few of those from back before I went to school. But I was always eat up with that stuff. And then, and of course, books right off the bat. And I know when I was in I was so excited the first day I went to school in the first grade. I read a book about dinosaurs. And, you know, I just got to eat up with dinosaurs, you know, a brontosaurus, and a, you know, now apatosaurus, but then Tyrannosaurus Rex and all that kind of stuff, Diplodocus. And I just loved that kind of stuff from the get-go. And so anyhow, I learned that the books were a window to the whole world that you never saw, you know, the things that, you know, you never dreamed of. It's like you're there when you're in the book. And so I've just been an avid reader from, in fact, I do all the same things now that I did probably in the period when I was just a baby to about 8 years old. I had already formed the things that I still do every day, you know. I just like that stuff. I found my first arrowhead when I was 8 years old. We had moved to the new house in Braxton County that I was telling you about, which we called a mansion because, well, it was to us. And anyhow, sitting on the front porch one day, not the front porch, there's three concrete steps that went up to the front porch. The front porch was all enclosed. But I was outside, sitting on the step, and there's a little sidewalk across the front of the house, both sides of the step, and then a little patch of ground between the sidewalk and the house on either side of the step. And Mom, you know, dug it up and made flowers, put flowers in there. And so I was sitting there just gazing around, happened to look down in that dirt and saw an arrowhead. And I knew it right away, Indian arrowhead. It was white, triangular point, with a red streak diagonally through it. And I got very enthused that Indians lived right on our house, right where our house was. So then the next day, I was digging under the back porch because it was just, it was up off the ground and had just like a little lattice around it, but you could get in there. And so I did. It was all dusty and dirty. So I dug through there and found another one the next day, about inch and a half, 2 inches long. And then not long after that, my brother Ted and my sister Jude got the fever, and they found one in the garden about 3 inches long. So there in the space of a week, we had 3 arrowheads, and we're just, I was enamored with it ever since then. About that same time, when I was 8, I heard a dog barking, because I go roam in the woods and stuff looking for treasures and animals and whatever, and I heard a dog barking. I went to see, and it was they had a groundhog up a walnut tree. It was on a pasture field, but it sloped pretty steep. And if you got on the uphill side, you're about level with the groundhog, you know. And so I threw rocks until I knocked him out of the tree. And then with a club, I beat him to death. It was like a fighting a grizzly bear. You know, just a little feller, you know. You know, I don't know. I was just little. I mean, when I was in 8th grade, I weighed 62 pounds. And so, you know, I don't know. When I was in the 3rd grade, I probably didn't weigh 40 pounds. So fighting a groundhog and beating to death was like, you know, caveman. It was really fun. I mean, not, I don't call it fun. It was a memorable experience. So anyhow, that got me started hunting. And so after that, I spent the rest of the summer. When I was out, I always had a good rock, you know, a baseball-sized rock or something. And I managed to kill 6 groundhogs and 2 skunks that summer with rocks when I was 8. And then that winter, my mom, because I'd just gone on and on about finding the arrowhead, and I wanted a bow. And so she got me a little 25-pound fiberglass bow and arrow for Christmas. And after that, I hunted groundhogs like religion for years with my bow. The first one Mom baked whole in the oven, and it turned purple and got hard. I mean, it was just like dark purple, and you couldn't think about eating the thing. It was awful. And we threw it out in the yard, and the dog wouldn't eat it, and I used it for archery practice for about a week. But after that, you know, she didn't bake them no more. After that, we would do them like rabbits. We would boil them. And then once they were cooked, bread them and fry them. Yeah, boil them enough to get the meat cooked and eat them. But, we, you know, we didn't eat a lot of them. I gave a lot of them to the dogs. We had, you know, dogs, and we didn't really feed the dog. We didn't buy dog food and stuff. We just fed him scraps and stuff every now and then. But it turned out years later, talking to one of our neighbors, he said, our dogs went to their house every day because they put food out back. They fed our dogs for us for years. We thought, we don't need to buy dog food. We felt like real scumbags then. When I was learning to hunt, of course, there was nobody to teach me other than what I read in books and stuff because my dad worked on the Great Lakes on the iron ore carriers. So he left in the middle of March and didn't get home till the week before Christmas. So he's gone 9 months out of the year. He's only home in the wintertime. I did hunt with him some later on. We'd grouse hunt and rabbit hunt when I got a little bit older. But he was not there a lot of the time. So most of my early hunting was with the bow in the summertime for groundhogs. And I had read somewhere, oh, I know who it was. It was G. Howard Gillian. He wrote a bow hunting column in Outdoor Life magazine for years and years. And he said, if you could go out and kill groundhogs with your bow, you could kill deer or bear or anything else. And so I practiced for years. And because there were no deer when I was a kid. They just, nobody's. I only remember hearing about one deer that somebody had killed, and Dad got a piece of it in the middle of the night, and we all had to quick grind it up in the hand grinder before the game warden found out that somebody had killed a deer. But I never saw a deer until I was 14 years old. You know, and I was in the woods all the time. And there just weren't any deer at that time. But then gradually, you know, one day I was squirrel hunting and at Table Rock, which is a cool rock. It's a big round rock, maybe 12 feet in diameter and flat, but about 10, 12 feet in the air with a toadstool stem under it. And so it's like a bar stool almost. It's real cool rock. And I was leaning against it, waiting for squirrels. And it was on election day, because I remember that all the people were at the school for election day. And all at once, I heard a noise. And sure enough, here came two deer come right up and crossed the ridge maybe 10 yards from me and down the other side. So then I became a deer hunter. There were deer there, and I hunted them every day for the next 6 years before I finally killed one when I was 20 with my bow. But one of the best ones, I had it here. I got wrote down the spice bush buck. I'd found a place where there was lots of deer tracks and some buck sign where they'd rub the trees and stuff like that. And I just thought that would be the place. If I could sit there long enough, I would see one. And so I decided, I went there like 5 o'clock in the morning, an hour before it got light. And there's a little spice bush there in this little gully. And I could see the hillside going up from there. But it was kind of clear in that little gully, smooth with grass and stuff and then trees and stuff all around. And I just backed up under that spice bush, and it was in fruit. It was real, they have wonderful smell. And so it was just like this little bower I was tucked back into. So I sat down there, 5 o'clock in the morning, waited for it to get light. And about noon, maybe 11 o'clock, middle of the day, I heard something, and then sure enough, I saw a buck deer coming down the hill. Nice, real beautiful 6-point. He had the white ring around the nose, and just a beautiful thing. And so he come down there and just walked right there, like right in the grass out there, about 20 yards. And I had raised up, pulled my bow back, and the arrow just went perfect, absolutely perfect. And about 3 feet before it got to him, it hit a little twig and nosedived under his chest, and off he went. And I was so thrilled that I had seen a deer and I had shot an arrow at one, and it stayed with me forever. And so then I continued. I didn't even go get the arrow. I just sat there all satisfied. It was wonderful. Sat there for 2 or 3 more hours. I'd put another arrow in my bow, and while I was sitting there holding the bow, not moving, a chickadee came and landed on the arrow about an inch from my knuckle and sat there a long time, and then flew away. And then I sat there till dark, and that was my day. I sat the whole day from dark to dark under that spice bush. That was the first day I'd hunted all day without moving from one spot. And that's what happened. I made a perfect shot. Nobody got hurt. No deer got killed. Nobody cared. It was wonderful. You know, when I was hunting, when I was learning to hunt, very early I realized that somehow I knew things that I couldn't have known. Strange, but like I learned, I call it following my feet. I'm walking along, and for no reason whatsoever, I feel an urge or a compulsion to go over here or go over there or do something. And I learned very early that you always follow that, because invariably there's something there. You know, I remember one time I was walking along turkey hunting, been turkey hunting all day, hadn't heard any turkeys, hadn't seen any turkeys. And I'm going up the hill, and there's a little gully coming off and another little rise over, and a big log right there, so I couldn't see over there. And I had gone past it and just happened to glance back and saw, you know, I really should go over and look at that. Like, no reason to look over that log, but I backed down the hill a little bit, went over to that log, and there were 12 turkeys right there. And I couldn't have seen them. Didn't they make no noise? And they were right there. And so that was, to me, following my feet. It took me years and years to learn to trust it totally. But There's something there that you just don't know. You hear about like guys in Vietnam having a feeling that something's going to happen, and you know, all kinds of stuff like it. Yeah, I don't know where that comes from, but anyhow, to me, yeah, the subconscious in your mind is so much bigger than the conscious mind, and so to me, that's what it is. There's something there. Your mind is working on it, but you're not aware of it. And so anytime you get an inkling, you should follow it, because it's got a root somewhere. There's a basis for it.
You know, Justin, I've only been hunting for 7 seasons now, but certainly out here, like in the mountains, doing an all-day hunt, there is something that happens where you like merge into the environment.
Yes.
And it's kind of like a mystical thing that happens. It's very strange, especially when you start out early and you're under the stars and you're just listening to like the wind in the pines. And then a few hours go by and it's like you melt into the landscape. It's like a meditative kind of experience.
Just watching the day go by, you know, from the same point. Yeah, seeing the sun as it moves from place to place to place, and how that changes. You'll be looking at something and there'll be a stump over there. And then an hour or two later, you're looking at, well, no, it don't look like a stump. It looks like a rock, or it looks like the head of a bear, or it looks like, and it's amazing how things change. And you get to see so many little things, you know, chipmunks, bugs. Yeah. And that's the great thing that I like about bow hunting, is because the vast majority of your time, you're just looking at stuff. You're not, you're just trying to, it's like you're there in your mind, not in your body. Your body is, your body's just part of everything, but your mind is seeing it all, like watching TV or something.
Seeing the secrets of nature.
Yeah, it's just wonderful. You get to see so many good things.
Like you said, the chipmunks, just like learning that chipmunks, I didn't ever realize chipmunks make a noise. They scream.
Oh, yeah.
And just like seeing them stand on a rock near you, just screaming. And you're like, wow. Or sunbathing, or standing there looking out at the horizon, just a little chipmunk standing upright for a minute on end. Like, just fascinating. And there'll be such long periods where nothing happens. And then you have these incredible animal encounters. You know, whether it's like a gray fox that I've seen come walk towards me, has no idea I'm there, and it starts rummaging and foraging, like watching it and climbing up a tree branch. It's just like, you get to see windows into the nature's secrets.
Yeah, I had a chipmunk one time. I was sitting at the base of a tree, and he jumped up on my boot, the toe of my boot, and then off onto my shin on my pants leg, and ran up my pants leg, not inside it, on top of it, and then got behind me where I was up against the tree, but he wouldn't hardly fit. But he struggled and pushed till he finally squeezed himself between me and tree and come out the other side. it was really fun.
That's so fun.
Yeah, I've got a couple more pretty good ones. One of them here. One day my boy Caleb and I were fishing. He was about 4 or 5. He wasn't real big yet. He wasn't even a great fisherman yet. But, you know, he wanted to go. And we were sitting on a series of ledges along Greenbrier River. Water was pretty shallow, but you could see good. And then it got deep out there just beyond the ledges. And I saw a big hellbender coming up the river. You know, a big salamander, you know, like 2 feet long, and 3 or 4 inches in diameter. Big old thing. And I'd never seen one, you know, for real before. I'd seen pictures of them. I knew all about them, but I'd never seen one. And so I could tell that it was going to come right where I was at. So I got my hand over the water. And when it got there, I just dropped my hand down, grabbed it around the back, front legs, and picked it up. Well, you know, its head and its legs are sticking between my fingers there. And they've got this big longitudinal fold down the back, and real slimy, and they're slippery. And so I held it up there in front of me to look at it, and Caleb was right there beside me. And it started slipping, so I squeezed it a little harder. Well, when I squeezed it a little harder, it gapped its mouth open and stuck its tongue out, just bleh. And then Caleb was right there, and he was grossed out by it. And his tongue came out. He goes, bleh. And the two tongues were the same size. Oh, it was really hilarious. But that thing, you know, I had it gripped in my hand, and it was past my armpit. It had to have been at least 2 feet long.
Wow.
I mean, big old thing. So then I put it back down in the water and let it swim away. But it was a wonderful experience.
Wow, I want to see one of those for sure.
Yeah, it was just wonderful.
Now, when we first had that really good conversation, because it was a historical event, you were wearing like a whole outfit that you made yourself, right? You were wearing buckskins.
Yes.
You did all that?
Yeah, I brain tanned deer hides and just the way the Indians did and all that kind of, I did all that kind of stuff. I love it. I've always been interested in the basics of life, of technology. I like to know about mechanics and electrical and all that kind of stuff, but also like about making metals from ore. And I mean, you know, I like basic things. And doing deer hides is wonderful. You don't need chemicals. You know, you scrape the flesh and membrane off the inside of the hide, stretch it in a frame, scrape the hair and the epidermis on the outside of the hide till you get raw hide, which you can use for all kinds of stuff. It'll keep forever like that. And all you've done is scrape the stuff off and let it dry. But then to make it into buckskin for using for clothes and stuff so it'll be soft, take the brains. I usually make them like a milkshake. Supposedly every animal has enough brains to tan its own hide. So I usually used, deer brains. And then later I got a place where I could get cow brains pretty easily. They're hard to get now. But anyhow, I would take a brain, put it in about a quart of warm water in a blender and whiz it up in there, make like a milkshake out of brains. And, the hide, when it's wet, you got to soften it, soak it in the raw hide, soak it and let it get wet all through. And it's all kind of slimy and not very nice and kind of cold. But then you put it in that brain mixture and instantly transforms it. It becomes drapey and smooth, and it's unbelievable. It's like hair conditioner, you put it in your hair. It just makes it, it just changes the texture of the skin altogether. So then you soak it good in that. I do like to do it overnight, but if it's warm, I'll just do it for a couple hours because the brains go bad really, really fast. So soak it in there, hopefully overnight, and then twist it and wring out all the moisture that you can. I'll usually roll the hide up and bring the ends together and take a stick and twist it and just squeeze all the water out of it you can get out. And then put it in the frame and start stretching it. You get a little wooden thing like a boat paddle and just stretch and pull and stretch and pull and stretch and pull. And you got to take it from when it's completely wet to it's completely dry. It doesn't do any good to do it when it's wet. It don't do any good to do it when it's dry. It's in that drying phase that you've got to stretch and pull. And it just, depending on the weather, it's anywhere from 5, 6 to 8 or 10 hours that you've got to keep that hide moving and stretching and pulling, because the fibers pull apart and then they go back together and they pull apart and they go back together, and you're fraying them as you do that. And ultimately they start fluffing up and getting thicker. You start out, it's paper thin, and then it will fluff up and get 4, 5, 6 times thicker and softer. So you just do that until it's completely dry. There's no moisture at all. And then it's soft. It's like terry cloth. It's really, really nice. But if it gets wet again, the fibers will stick back together. So then you got to take it, make it into a bag and smoke it over a fire with lots of smoke, but not much heat. Lots of times you can run a pipe in the ground and have the smoke come out a distance from the fire. That helps too. And then the smoke coming up through the hide, it will bleed through. And then you turn it inside out and do the other side too. And that changes it from being an ivory whitish color to brown or tan, depending on what you're using to smoke with. Usually some kind of punky wood. You don't want, hard, dry coals. You don't want something punky that burns real slow and just makes lots of smoke. And that of course, puts a smell of smoke into it, but that coats those fibers with tars and stuff, from the unburned gases and from the wood, and so that it's they don't stick together when they get wet. Doesn't keep it from getting wet. You're out in buckskins, and it rains on you, you get wet. But when it dries, it'll still be soft.
Did you sew yours up traditionally, like with sinew, or did
I sewed mine just with strips of buckskin.
Okay.
I cut quarter inch strips around the hide, and then just punched holes with an awl, and then laced it together.
Now, have you hunted in your buckskins?
Oh yeah.
Wow. How do you feel that it compares to modern clothing, to wool?
I've got a great book. Blue Mountain Buckskinning by Jim Riggs. He does a lot of brain tanning hides out in Washington, D.C., or Washington State. And he has these crude cartoons in his book. And here it shows your average American couple standing there. And then your average American couple in buckskins. And they're all smiley. It feels wonderful on your skin.
Really?
Wonderful. It's just, I don't know. It's just a nice, it's nice.
Now, how about
and it's durable. That shirt I've got upstairs, I'll show it to you in a bit.
Yeah.
I've had it probably 25 years, at least.
Wow. Now, how about temperature and stuff?
It's warm. It's pretty windproof. If you just got that on, you'll probably be cold, but if you put it on over a sweater or something.
Okay.
Which, lots of times I'll do. Now, I actually need to do a bunch of clothing. I owe my wife a dress. I've got the hides all done. I just need to make her the dress. I made one for a friend several years ago, wedding dress for her out of buckskin.
So. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That is neat.
Yeah, she was really into it, and we were really good friends, and she was helping me do a hide one time. You were standing there feet to feet. I got one side. She were just just pulling and stretching, and trying to soften the hide up. She's really into it. She said, "Boy, I'd love to have a buckskin dress." I said, "That would be an enormous amount of work," but of course, I immediately started working on it. And so when she got married a few months later, then. There it was. I had her a nice dress.
That's so cool. Well, I mean, I think we could wrap it up. This has been a long and winding, awesome conversation.
That's fine and dandy. There's all kinds of stories. They don't end. I've had a wonderful life doing things, and I really enjoy it.
Well, I love your passion. Clearly, you're very passionate for life, and I think there's really something I've heard psychologists say, what you said earlier about how as a child you're doing the same things as a child. Yeah. I've heard a psychologist say that the most fulfilling life is to do what you did as a child, but not revert into being a child. So you keep maturing as a human being, but all the things that you had as a child are the things you bring further into your life. I think that's awesome. And clearly you're such a passionate, joyous person. I love it.
I'd like to say just two more things.
Yeah, please.
Okay. Well, one of them just slipped my mind. I'll tell you one of them.
Okay, you're holding a piece of paper that's in the shape of an evergreen tree. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyhow. Well, the last thing I'd like to say is, best thing ever happened to me, absolute best thing in my entire life that ever happened, was having kids. I had a boy, Caleb, or a girl, Hannah, first, and then Caleb. And they're just wonderful. And I'm sorry, I don't know. Best thing ever happened to me. They're still beautiful. The best people I would rather be with in anywhere.
I love the name Caleb.
And so anyhow, you know, I didn't worry about being a parent. I always enjoyed and just loved my kids. I mean, I felt like my job was not to direct them, but to help them do what they wanted to do. Mm. And so anyhow, this paper that I told you about, my boy Caleb made this in the second grade. Mm-hmm. It was Christmas time, and their assignment was to take the picture of the tree and decorate it with crayons, you know, put stuff on it. And
so it's an illustration?
Yeah, and then they were supposed to, they were going to decorate the tree, and then mm-hmm. on the backside, they're going to write a story mm-hmm. about Christmas. Okay, he's in the second grade. He's just a little feller. And so this is what he does. He gets a D, you know, which is almost an F. And here's the picture. And what he did, instead of putting ropes and colored balls and stuff on it, he drew brown pine cones and green needles. And on the box that the tree was in, he made roots and a trunk. Mm. So he turned the Christmas tree into a tree. And he got a D because, well, he went outside the lines. And I knew he was going to be okay because he wasn't going to let them squeeze him into the mold that he was being squeezed into. Mm. And here's his story. I have to read his story. The best Christmas ever would be if there was 6 feet of snow and 10 feet of presents. That would be great. I would open presents for a week. Then after I had opened them all, I would fool around with them for a month. When I was done with the presents, I would go outside and play in a life-size snow castle. My dad and I would have huge snow battles and fence with icicles. That would be the best Christmas ever.
That's wonderful.
And he got D for it.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. He brought a dead Christmas tree back into a living pine tree in the forest.
And I knew he was going to be okay. And I don't know. It just made me so proud that I might not have been the best father, but I was a happy one. We had good times and still do.
In the pines where the sun never shined and it shivered when the cold wind blow. Oh, if I minded what grand old said, oh, where would I have been tonight? I'd have been in the pines where the sun never shined and it shivered when the cold wind blow. The longest train I ever saw went down the Georgie line. The engine, it stopped at a 6 mile post. The cabin never left the town. Now, darling, don't tell me no lie. Where did you stay last night? I stayed in the pines where the sun never shined and I shivered when the cold wind blow. The prettiest little girl that I ever saw went walking down the line. Her hair, it was of a curly type, her cheeks was rosy red. Now, darling, don't tell me no lie. Where did you stay last night? I stayed in the pines where the sun never shined and I shivered when the cold wind blow. The train run back 1 mile from town and killed my girl, you know. Her head was caught in the driver wheel, her body I never could find. Oh, darling, oh, darling, don't tell me no lie. Where did you stay last night? I stayed in the pines where the sun never shined, and I shivered when the cold wind blew. The best of friends is far sometimes, and why not you and I? Now, darling, oh, darling, don't tell me no lie. Where did you stay last night? I stayed in the pines where the sun never shined, and I shivered when the cold wind blew. Oh, transportation has brought me here. Take a money for to carry me away. Oh, darling, now, darling, don't tell me no lie. Where did you stay last night? I stayed in the pines where the sun never shined, and I shivered when the cold wind blew.